For the next two episodes, I wanted to share with you a recording I made about how we use data as humans. The idea is we want to understand how our brains work to analyze the data that we get every second of every day in such powerful ways, but also how these shortcuts and strengths that we have also open us up to making a couple of repeating mistakes in how we understand the world. Through these next two podcast episodes, I'll show you some signs to look for when you might be about to make one of these mistakes and exactly what you can do to avoid making those mistakes again. The great thing about understanding this is it helps us be better in the decisions we make at work, whether it's to figure out what donor we should contact again or how to reassess the way that we actually evaluated our latest program. But it also helps you in deciding about what schools to go to or how to handle your kids' misbehavior at school, all sorts of different things. We use incoming data and we have to understand how our brains process that information and how sometimes little tricks that we use to help us navigate the world more effectively can also lead us astray. Hello, and welcome to Heart, Soul, and Data, where we explore the human side of analytics to help amplify the impacts of those out to change the world. With me, Alexandra Mannerings. I want to start by making it very clear. Our mind is unparalleled in its ability to receive, parse through, and act on incoming information. After all, we are exposed to millions of bits of data from our senses every second of the day. And without any conscious effort at all, our brains can pick out the tiny fraction that's important, and can understand it, and then apply it. Too many conversations on bias share what's bad about the way that we think, making it sound like we are broken and flawed. We do need to understand that we are extraordinarily powerful, and it's often the very things that make us so powerful and high-functioning that get called out as bugs in our system, as if they need to be squashed out of existence. But we can't change the core setup of our brains, and not only can't we shouldn't want to. Instead, we can find ways to mitigate the downsides of these strengths while embracing who we are as humans. Consider the fact, for example, that computers still can't match us in image recognition, even with these incredible advances in AI that we've been having recently. With the best technology today, it takes hundreds of thousands of images for computers to get good at telling the difference just between, say, cats and dogs. You have to say, this is a cat and this is a dog, over and over again, in all sorts of different contexts, inside, outside, different backgrounds, different colors. And it's only recently, very recently, can this be done with accuracy and speed that even gets close to our own ability to make these distinctions. In other words, as we help computers work more like our brains with neural networks and advanced computing, they're getting more, not less, powerful. And my kids, who have grown up with cats and dogs, could recognize and correctly identify the difference after seeing only a couple. Think about this. After exposure to 5 or 6 real dogs and real cats, plus some very different drawings of them in books, at 15 months old, they knew what made a dog and a cat a cat. Yet computers have to have so much more training to be able to make this level of clear distinctions. That extraordinary ability to make sense of a world in an ordered categorical ways, that means at a glance, you can know whether to throw a tennis ball or a ball of yarn to a 4-legged creature you've never met before. So we are pattern-making champions. And that means that we can make sense of the world very quickly. The downside, of course, is that it means we find patterns when there aren't any there.
So we can make sense of the world quickly, right? Because we're so good at making patterns. But that's bad for dealing with the few situations when those patterns actually don't exist. So I was enjoying the fact that the other day, my son asked me why it looks like there is a man in the moon. As a fun note, the last time I talked about this, someone told me that in China, actually the story is that there's a rabbit in the moon. But there's two answers here to why we see things when we look at the moon. And the first and boring explanation is that there are craters that just coincidentally happen to sort of resemble something like a face or a rabbit or whatever you see. But the second part of it is that our brains are wired and primed to recognize faces. We come actually pre-programmed to find those kinds of patterns in the world. As infants, for example, it is really, really important for us to be able to understand what's a human face and which humans we're looking at. Are they strangers? Are they family? Are they people we're safe with? This wiring to see faces and other important patterns means we see them everywhere. We see Jesus in burnt toast and we see a man in the moon. The ability of our brains, right, to come not as blank slates, but pre-programmed to expect those kinds of patterns is what makes us so good at finding them quickly. It's why after 5 or 6 times, we can make that pattern instead of hundreds of thousands that computers, which cannot be pre-programmed to expect anything, need so much exposure, right? Our toddlers are still light years ahead of what our best computers can do in this ability to create accurate categories on minimal information. But being able to find patterns so quickly means it helps us know more about our world, but it also means that we see them when they're not there, right? We're pre-programmed to find them. And so when they aren't there, we expect them and we will look for them anyway. So we do this not just with, you know, Jesus and toast, but we do it when we have data that is actually randomly distributed. We expect there to see patterns. So even if the data are really noisy all over the place, we will make them have patterns. A great example of this was in World War II. So London was getting absolutely hammered by German bombers. And as these bombs fell all across the city, the Londoners started noticing that certain areas got hit really hard and other areas were left untouched. Well, how could this be? Wasn't Germany just trying to level London? Why would they leave some areas untouched? And they decided it must be because there was something really important to the Germans in those areas, like a spy. And they didn't want to kill their own spies that were embedded in London. And this seems pretty reasonable, right? Except that the bombing was random. Guided missiles didn't exist then. And so in a truly random spread of bombs, it would actually be really weird not to have some areas that were heavily hit and some areas that were untouched. After all, think about when you flip a coin. Does it alternate heads, tails? No, you'll get clusters of heads and clusters of tails, even if the coin is completely fair. That is how randomness works. The problem's with us. We expect random to mean uniform. And the moment we see anything different, areas with more numbers or less numbers or more events or less events, whatever it is, we make that mean something. We listen to the noise, that random variation of up and down, and we think that it's music. Most of the time, right, the directions that we get from the world come in like the worst phone connection you could imagine, with words just buried under that static. And we're so good at picking out those hidden words and getting the information we need from this crazy, chaotic world. But it means that when we're actually just listening to static, we still think there are words. So what can we watch for? How can we be aware of when we're stuck in a situation where, in fact, there isn't a signal to pick out of that noise? The first red flag is something with very high variability, right? If something you're considering in your data changes a lot, like that's just the nature of something you're watching a very volatile stock. You're watching changes in your donors and you happen to have donors that will donate wildly different amounts. It's going to be difficult to tease out real patterns, right? Real ones, not ones that you think are there just because we have this ability to create patterns. If you don't know how variable something might be, that's a problem too, right? If you're looking at a new set of information or data and you're unsure it's new to you, you don't know whether variability is normal or not in this, how are you going to be able to best tell whether you should look at a few days worth of data, a few months, a few years, right? So you need to be paying attention to identifying variability in your data. The next thing you have to look at is when you have made a conclusion locally that you leap to applying globally. Right? So there's a joke about a philosopher, a biologist, and a mathematician go on a walk and they see a cow in the field, right? And the philosopher is like, oh, in this area, cows are brown. And the biologist says, this farmer has brown cows. And the mathematician says, look, that cow is brown on this side, right? One piece of information could lead to a number of different conclusions. And you have to pay attention to how broadly you are defining those conclusions from the information that you have. So are you extending those conclusions in a way that is justifiable by the information that you've had, or are you extending them too far? And we have a strong sense to take information that applies in a very specific situation and make this global assumption about it. Because again, we've decided this is a pattern and therefore universally applicable. So for example, you send out an email with a new subject line to 10 donors and you get 8 donations from those 10 donors. You could decide this is the best subject line ever and we should use it all the time. Or is the correct conclusion, this subject line worked really well for these 8 donors? Or is it somewhere in between? This subject line's very good for donors who meet these criteria. You have to start noticing how far you're reaching from the information that you're getting and see if you're making a pattern out of a coincidence or taking a big pattern from small facts. So if you recognize one of these red flags, what can you do? The first thing is to be more mindful of your language and how you talk about the information that you have. And this can feel pedantic, but it actually is going to help you recognize how much do you actually know and how much are you extrapolating or extending beyond the data that you're using. An example, instead of saying, young kids love this program we're doing, you could say, over the last year, kids that were aged 5 to 10 were staying enrolled twice as long as those kids aged 11 to 17, right? That's actually the data you had on hand. And by using the words that are tied to the data you actually have on hand, it'll make you more conscious of how far you might be extending them. The next thing is to look for multiple sources of evidence about that pattern. The saying goes, once is nothing, twice is a coincidence, and 3 times is a pattern. It's not about having 3 individual data points. It's about, do you have 3 sets of data points that can help you reinforce this pattern from 3 different situations and contexts, right? So if you think this program works on youth, great. Have you tried that in different locations? Have you tried that with different groups of youth? Have you tried that program on different ages to see if it wasn't, in fact, that it worked better with youth, but that your youth ended up being much more in one demographic than your older students. And it's actually that demographic it works well for, not the age range, et cetera, right? Find multiple ways of triangulating that evidence for your pattern to see if it persists. Then in situations where you have high variability, there are actually statistical methods you can use to still tease out meaningful patterns. These might not be ones that you yourself know, but you can work with somebody who could help you identify those sorts of stats that would help you manage noise in your data so that you don't jump to conclusions that aren't justified actually by the numbers. All right, so trait number 2, we know how to make things happen. And this is why we live in one of the most incredible ages of that humankind has known, right? We drive forward advancement scientifically and culturally because we can figure out how to actually make things happen. The downside for that is that it means that we create these causal connections when they don't exist. You only can make things happen when you figure out that doing X makes Y happen. And that's how we can drive that advancement. But that gets in the way when we think that Y causes Z, and in fact, there's no connection whatsoever. So there's a great website called Spurious Correlations that takes real data and shows how closely these things can move together, right? And I love showing these because the data pattern here is real. These aren't falsified numbers. These are actually the numbers that go together and they move so tightly. They have something called correlation. Right? We see a relationship that when one goes up, the other goes up. Or you can have an inverse relation when one goes up, the other goes down, and that it always tracks. But when we look at this, there's no actual way these could be causally connected. They are only correlated. The age of Miss America is connected to murders by steam, hot vapors, and hot objects. No, there's no causal mechanism there. There's no way that one of those things could influence the other. But the pattern is incredibly compelling. And what happens is it's easy for us to see here when they're what's called spurious, right? They look true, but are clearly wrong. We can tell that because I can look at that and say, there's no possible way. But we get ourselves in situations where we could think of a way that 2 things that are correlated might actually be causal. And we jump to this conclusion that therefore, because they move together, because they occur at the same time, or they increase or decrease together, that must mean they are causal. And a very tragic example of this is that in 1998, Andrew Wakefield and several co-authors published a scientific paper with falsified evidence, right? Made up evidence that the MMR vaccine caused disorders on the autism spectrum. Now, eventually, the publishing journal pulled the paper when they recognized that the data had all been made up. And they've done huge studies since then on hundreds of thousands of children, showing that there is 0 causal relationship between receiving the vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella, and for your child developing any symptoms on the autism spectrum. But this thought continues to persist to this day. And in fact, people are still making decisions about whether to vaccinate their children because of this false idea. Now, there are a lot of facets on this issue, not the least of which is how we interpret and relate to neurodivergence. But relevant to what we're talking about today, there's a significant reason why this persistence continues, because the symptoms of autism spectrum disorders often show up around the same time that children get their first round of the MMR vaccine. It is a complete coincidence. It's just that both those things happen around the same age. But it is very compelling to adults who have children that seem to be, and I'll put this in quotes, developing normally, suddenly start exhibiting completely different behavior than they had before. And that's why we must always treat correlations as nothing more than coincidence, no matter how suggestive they might seem, until we have strong evidence for causation rather than just correlation. So what can we watch for? Honestly, anytime you hear somebody make a causal claim, you should sit and question it for a second, right? Whether it is a headline about bacon or coffee causing cancer, or an advertisement saying our new CRM increases donations by 20%, right? Any causal statement should make you at least raise an eyebrow. You should stop and think about it. You especially should think about any supposed causation when the primary association between the thing happening and the thing it's supposed to cause is temporal, meaning they happen at the same time. Right? Lots of things happen at the same time because there's other things that cause them to happen at that same time. One of them is that murders go up along with ice cream sales and they drop when ice cream sales go down. Ice cream sales and murders go up, ice cream and murders go down at the same time. So they have this temporal relationship. Things happen at the same time. The problem is those things are both driven by temperature and weather. Apparently, the more people get out and they're around other people, they're more likely to kill other people, but they're also more likely to buy ice cream. So the thing is, you have to be very suspicious of things where the main association is that they happen at the same time. Even if they consistently always happen at the same time, there could be something else completely different that's making them happen and they have nothing to do with each other. The next thing is you have to be really careful about easy or only like tangentially related measurements about things that are really complex. Now, as a data person, I often have to lean into suboptimal measurements, right? Things that maybe aren't exactly what we want to be measuring because the world is a really complicated place. But you want to be careful if those really easy measurements about something really complicated are telling you that there is a supposed causal relationship, because it's hard to truly tease out that causation when you've oversimplified the situation. So for example, it's very easy to take your temperature if you're feeling ill and decide if that means that you're sick, right? A high fever is a clear and often accurate indication of illness, but we can get the causation wrong here, right? That correlation's very tight. If I'm running 103 degree fever, I'm sick. But we oftentimes then jump to the fact that the fever is causing the illness, right? I have a high fever, it's making me feel ill. I'm going to treat the fever and that will treat the illness. But in fact, there's a lot of great research coming out now that fever is your body's way of fighting the illness. And that for some illnesses, if you let the fever run for a couple of days, it will shorten the length of time that you are sick. So illness is a very complex situation. Fevers, very easy to measure. And so we have to make sure that we're not using simple measurements to help us jump to conclusions about therefore how they're connected. So what can we do if we notice one of these three red flags? Again, like we talked about with the first one, or our first trait with our patterns, being more careful in the language you use will help you be more aware of what you're stating. So I'm going to introduce you to a phrase that statisticians and scientists use all the time, which is associated with. So rather than saying fevers cause illness, we would say fevers are associated with illness. Or rather than saying, you know, high social media engagement causes more donation, we can say we notice that people who are engaged with us on social media are associated with a higher chance of them donating, but we don't know which way it might go, or maybe something else that's driving it, right? Entirely. So when we use associated with, it helps us remember that we might not have that great evidence for causing, and just that we see two things that happen together. The next thing is, like we triangulate our evidence for our patterns, see if you can repeat it. So if you think flipping this switch makes that thing happen, does it happen every time, right? Like every time I do this, do I see this other thing happen? Can I do it in a different scenario or situation and also have it happen? Or best of all, see if you can experiment. If you think this causes that, can you create a scenario that would help you show that, yes, in fact, changing this one thing results in a different outcome? For example, if you think that a new donor form on your website is going to be causal to an increase in donations, right? It's going to cause you to get more donations. You can do what's called an A/B test. You can actually use some very simple platforms where you can create two versions, the old version of the form and the new version of the form. And when a person comes to your website, they will randomly be shown one or the other of those forms. And if you truly see a measurable difference in donations on your new form versus your old form, that is great evidence towards the fact that the new form is in fact different, right? It makes a difference. It causes better donations. But if you just throw that new form up there, no evidence, and you see an increase in donations, what if you put that new form up in December and you're comparing it to November and October's numbers? Well, it might be the fact that it's just December and year-end giving that caused the increase and it had nothing to do with your new form. But if you'd done the A/B test in December and you still see your new form performing better, then you can rule out that it was December making it your donations go up and had something to do with the form. The last thing is, again, to just remain skeptical. Ask lots of questions about causality. What actually is the evidence when someone says, my CRM is going to drive increased donations by 20%? Well, what's your evidence for that, CRM company? Are you just telling me that when somebody buys your CRM, they get 20% more than before? Are you letting them try things in your new platform and their old platform? How do you not know that they're on an upward climb, right? They've been increasing donations. They see this trajectory. It's time to invest in a new system. And whether or not they had changed, that trajectory would have continued. But you need to know what the evidence for, and you shouldn't just accept causal statements. All right. Third trait here. You have to see it, believe it to see it, right? We always like to say, I have to see it to believe it. But in fact, the way we work is I have to believe it to see it. So the reason we have this trait is it allows us to avoid overwhelm. If we had to constantly question every piece of information that came into us and say, is this real? This way I'm processing the world, this framework I have, does this piece of information support it or not? You would not function going through your day because there is too much information to be able to handle that level of scrutiny on everything coming in. However, our great ability to maintain consistency in moving through a chaotic world means that we're not so good for when it comes to actually needing to update what we think. So we're going to play a little game here. And for those on the call, if you're up for it, you can drop things in the chat for the question that I'm going to ask you. If not, you can just play it in your head and answer this. So imagine that you work at a toy factory and you're getting reports that there's more broken toys than usual coming off of your assembly line, and you need to figure out what the cause is. And one of your quality control folks says, I think it's all the animal toys. Right? The animal toys are the ones that are actually driving these broken toys. You're running late. You're trying to check before you report to your boss about what it's going to be. And you can only check two things. You've got a truck toy that you could look at to see if it's broken. You've got an animal toy that you could look at to see if it's broken. You've got a bag that has one of the broken toys. So you could open that up and look to see if it was an animal or a truck. Or you have a box that's ready to go out that's not broken. And you could check that toy that's not broken to see if it's an animal or a truck. You've only got time to look at two of these four things. Which two would you look at to try to test and prove your hypothesis that it's the animal toys that are responsible for needing to all be repaired, right? They're responsible for all the broken toys. So you can drop it in the chat if you want, what you think you would check, or write it on a little sticky note. All right, so the most common answer, and I've done this a bunch of times, is the first one you check is the animal. Right? You check the animal toy to see if it's broken, because that gives you evidence about, is it broken, right? The most common is you check the animal to see if it's broken, and you check the broken toy to see if it's an animal, because both of those things would reinforce your idea that they are, in fact, the animals that are breaking things. Makes total sense, right? We want to find evidence that supports our hypothesis. Well, here's the problem. If trucks are contributing to the breaking of the toys, none of the evidence that you looked at would show you that, right? All you've collected is evidence in support of your statement. You haven't tested it against something that could disprove the statement that it's only the animal toys responsible for needing all the repairs. So the most effective way of doing this would be to check the broken toy, right? Is it an animal? And then to check the truck to see if the truck is broken. The reason we don't think that way is because we don't like trying to disprove ourselves all the time. What we have is something called confirmation bias. In confirmation bias, instead of thinking about things that would disprove the position we have, we continually seek out information that will uphold and confirm what we believe. One step worse than that, it's not just that we don't like seeking out information that could challenge us. We will much more readily discount information that does make it to us if it contradicts the beliefs that we already have. The upside to this is it helps us maintain our own sense of confidence and security and avoid an incredibly challenging mindset of what's called cognitive dissonance. When you have two things in your head that don't line up, that's very disorienting. It makes it hard to navigate through the world. So we have confirmation bias to help us hold ourselves together and go through a world that oftentimes just doesn't make sense. But it means that when it is time to update some of our beliefs and our perceptions about the world, it's very hard for us. So what can we do? What do we need to watch out for when we're slipping from comforting sense-making and having the world actually function for us into the dangers of confirmation bias that are keeping us from being able to fix a belief that is holding us back or is no longer correct? The first one, and this is a little disconcerting, right, is that anytime you're like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense, that actually is a red flag for confirmation bias, right? Anything that is new that, you know, hits your brain and you're like, yep, fits in perfectly with my worldview, just makes sense. You're probably evaluating it from a point of view of confirmation bias rather than actually processing that information. Now, again, you don't need to reevaluate every single piece of information that comes in. But if it's relevant to an important or complex decision and you're like, yep, yep, all that data makes sense, you may want to take a step back, slow down and say, hang on, am I legitimately looking for information that might challenge me, or am I only sticking with stuff that makes sense? Then when you go out and find the data that actually does challenge the position that you have or challenge what just naturally makes sense to you about a position, you'll find yourself having this knee-jerk reaction of like, oh, there must be something wrong with that data. No. I know our donor numbers had to have gone up. This new CRM was definitely supposed to work. The fact that we see donor numbers going down, there must be something wrong with the system. If you find yourself doing that and immediately just discounting information coming in that's challenging, also a flag for confirmation bias. So what can we do? I have a phrase that I love, but it does sometimes annoy a lot of the people that I talk about, which is when they're very convinced of something, instead of trying to disprove what they think right now, I ask them, what data would change your mind? You're very sure that your new website is going to drive engagement in your new program. What data, if you saw it, would change your mind that the website isn't going to improve engagement with this program? And I have that person tell me what it would take. Because then if I know ahead of time, they've stated, here's the bar it has to reach. If I have that data, if I go find it and I bring it back and I can show them, they're much more likely to have to say, wow, okay, yes, you're right. I said, if I saw that, it would help me change my mind. And you just showed that to me. Whereas if you don't ask that and you bring them that data that shows it doesn't work, it's much easier to discount incoming information because you haven't primed yourself to accept it. This works on yourself too. So when I'm really convinced of something, sometimes I have to sit back and be like, hey, hang on, what would make me stop believing this? What would make me change my mind on this position? And then I have to go out and get it. I have to go check that thing. It's like checking the truck. You've got to go find out, does that information exist? If I've said this is what it would take, is that out there? And you can formally do this in groups that you're having discussions with, where you can assign what I call the devil's analyst role. So they talk about how the role of like an ombudsman was to always disagree with whatever the leader was suggesting, right? They have to play that devil's advocate where they say something and we're like, well, what about, and you have to sort of present the other side. The data equivalent of this, the devil's analyst, is to say, what data would disprove this position? Do we have it? What's wrong with whatever data is being presented? What are the limitations of it? So that there's always somebody who's there thinking about that disproving rather than just being comfortable with proving things we already expect. The more you can get comfortable with conflicting information, the easier those first two steps will be. And so I recommend it's sort of like avoidance exposure therapy, right? If there's something like spiders you really don't like, hanging out around like the tarantula at the zoo, even if it's behind glass, taking a look at it can help you get more comfortable about being around spiders. Same with information that you disagree with. The more you can have exposure to high quality information that you disagree with, the more comfortable you'll be in that space.
I hope you enjoyed the first half of this presentation about using data while human. Tune in next week and we'll cover the second half and the remaining challenges that we face as humans navigating this complex world. If you would like to see the YouTube video recording of this presentation or download the slides or link to the second half of this recording once it's out, you can do so at our show notes page, which is heartsouldata.com/usingdatawhilehuman, all one word. Please also feel free to leave me comments about your experiences with some of these strengths and weaknesses. And if you have any questions or places you'd like me to dive a little bit deeper, I also love hearing that as well. Thank you so much for your time today, and I wish you the best on your analytic journey. You have been listening to Heart, Soul, and Data. This podcast is brought to you by Maracanus, an analytics education, consulting, and data services company devoted to helping nonprofits and social enterprises amplify their impacts and thrive through data. You can learn more at maracanos.com, M-E-R-A-K-I-N-O-S.com.